Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to Madison's Notes, the official podcast of Princeton University's James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions. I'm your host, Annika Nordquist. We are about to have a conversation about Plutarch, and there's really no one better to discuss it than today's guest, Dr. Hugh Liebert, who's a professor of political science at West Point, where he also directs their graduate scholarship program and co-directs their American Foundations minor. He's also a current visiting fellow here at the James Madison Program. Hugh's specialty is the history of political thought. His most recent book is on Edward Gibbon, which you should absolutely check out. But today, we're here to discuss his book, Plutarch's Politics, winner of the Delba Winthrop Award for Excellence in Political Science. In this conversation, Dr. Liebert will be presenting his own views and not those of the United States Military Academy. And with no further ado, I hope you enjoy. Hugh, welcome to the show. It's such a delight to have you on.
Thank you.
So I want to kick us off. There's sort of a lot of nitty gritty things that one could ask about Plutarch and how to treat him as a historian, but just kind of at a very broad level about his project, you have a really lovely quote in your book that Plutarch views the citizen's soul as a window into the city. And I think it's a really beautiful observation and a really lovely way of summarizing Plutarch's project, but also quite different from how we think about political philosophy and the role of politicians today. So can you kind of unpack that statement and explain why Plutarch thinks that and what we can learn about Plutarch from that observation?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for that question, Icon. Thank you for having me here. I'm really delighted to have the opportunity to talk about Plutarch. He's one of my favorite authors, and he wrote one of my favorite books. So Plutarch says that he writes about the souls of individuals, right? So he's interested, he says, not in writing histories and describing the great battles and every little detail of them, but in looking at the soul, which shows itself, he says, often more in little things and little anecdotes than it does in great battles. So he comes from a broadly Platonic background, we can say. Right. He studied, at the Academy under this philosopher, Platonic philosopher Ammonius. And he seems to take seriously, I think, the parallel that Plato, Socrates establishes between city and soul. However, his direction that he goes in analyzing it starts more from the soul and uses that as a window to the city. Then, from the city kind of working down through its institutions and understanding the character of the citizens.
Looking a little bit more into the way that historians generally view Plutarch. You've observed, a lot of people have observed, people don't tend to take him that seriously. And to kind of strongman that a little bit, I think, he provides some of these details which feel quite salacious that one wouldn't expect someone who is being super serious and minute about the sources to take seriously. And two, some of these figures, we have plenty of evidence that they existed, Alexander the Great, Pericles, and then you have these people like Romulus, who are essentially mythological, and they get equal rent, if you will. They sort of get an equal amount of space. And so given that, as historians, how seriously should we take Plutarch's project? Is it the case that it just sort of doesn't have anything useful at all to say except about what Plutarch thinks about these thinkers? Or is there something kind of broader that we can say in terms of what they're useful for historically?
Yeah, as historians, I think we probably approach the text differently than just as curious people who are trying to understand political life,
right,
or philosophers who are trying to understand something, permanent about the world and about the human soul. I will say that as historians, I don't think Plutarch is worthless entirely, but, we always have to keep in mind that he tells us, if you're looking for history, that's not my main concern. Now, it's not that he's indifferent to history. For instance, in the, we'll occasionally refer to his work as a kind of history. He says in the introduction to the Romulus and Theseus, he's very well aware that we don't necessarily have access to what actually happened with these guys.
Right.
So he says he's trying to make myth look like history. In that case. So it's not that he's unconcerned with history. It's that his main focus is not history, but the soul. So he presents himself to us much more as we might say a psychologist, I think we could say, a philosopher, a political philosopher, maybe an ethicist in some sense, rather than a historian. He wrote a lot, though. Right. And for a lot of these figures, he's one of the main sources we have. A lot of the fragments we have of ancient historians whose texts have been lost to us come from Plutarch's lives and from the other works he wrote that are collected in the Moralia. So, you know, he's worth something. But we should approach him, I think, primarily as he asks us to approach him, at least in this work, The Parallel Lives, which is, you know, as more of a philosopher, less of a historian.
Yes, and I'm going to ask about the philosophy in just a second, but just because I'm quite curious about this and I can't resist, I mean, how exactly does one go about doing the kind of research that Plutarch does to produce this in the ancient world? Because I think when we read these things, we just sort of take it for granted that either he was sort of making it up or it just sort of came out of nowhere. But in fact, I mean, what's sort of the process to figure out what goes into this type of text?
Yeah, it's such a good question. I wish I knew the answer to that. I don't. We know, or we're pretty certain, we scholars of Plutarch, yeah. Right, that he wrote the bulk of the Parallel Lives from this little town, Chaeronea, where right. he was born and died. A very famous town because a lot of battles were fought there. But, you mm-hmm. know, in Boeotia, not too far from Thebes, not too far from the Delphic Oracle. He comments at one point in the beginning of the Demosthenes that he's writing from a little town. Without a great library, it would be a lot easier to write the kinds of works he's writing if you were in Rome or Alexandria or some other place with more, you know, voluminous holdings, right, and the kind of things. So what does he have? He probably has the texts that he owns. He seems to come from a fairly well-off family. Mm. So, you know, we should assume that he has some texts ready at hand on his desk, I think. But he seems also just to have a capacious memory. To have studied, you know, many things at various points in his life and to have held on to them in such a way that he can draw on them when he's writing his lives. And we should probably also assume a little bit of authorial license. You know, many of the details he gives us to fill out a scene and make it feel vivid and real, which he's extraordinarily gifted at doing, you know, stuff that he couldn't possibly know. He can tell it to us as if he was there. It doesn't offend my sensibilities too much, you know, to just assume that he's inferring and kind of filling out a scene right. in a beautiful way in order to drive after this very serious, not just aesthetic, but serious purpose that he has of investigating the soul and teaching his readers something about it.
Right. Well, how dare authors write in a captivating way, not to be banned in academic discourse. Right. I mean, let's dig a little bit more into kind of the biographical element of it. I had a previous conversation on this podcast with Johnny Burtka, who had written a book about statesmanship. And one of the distinctions that we talked about was between a work about statesmanship written by someone who's actually in a political role or someone who's in a more advisory role. And so where does Plutarch fall within that? Does he have any political experience that he's using to write these lives?
It's such an interesting question with Plutarch. The easy answer is no, not really, in the sense that he doesn't have a role anything like that of Alexander the Great, right. Cato the Younger, right. you know, these founders.
Right.
So not that. But he's more politically experienced, and I think we, coming with our assumptions about this divide between philosophy and political life, or the contemplative life, the practical life, that sort of thing, we would assume, right? So what we know from him, which mostly comes from his own, you know, accounts of his life, which is an interesting fact about his works. He gives us accounts of his life in the life and lets us see a little bit of that. You know, he's born in Chaeronea. He studies in Athens. We know he goes to Rome. We know he has friends among the ruling elites of the day under the empire. I should say his years are about 45 to 120. Mm-hmm. We know he was a Roman citizen. We know he served as an ambassador from Greece to Rome. We know that among these friends he has in the Roman elite are senators who hold important military commands, like Sosius Senecio, who's the dedicatee of the Parallel Lives and several works that are collected in the Moralia as well. So we should, I think, you know, assume that Plutarch is writing not only for philosophers, but for practical men, statesmen of his day under the empire. Who might benefit from reflecting on the kinds of souls that Plutarch presents to them. It's also worth keeping in mind, though, that Plutarch, even though he's not holding these offices as consul or you know what have you, is involved in politics on the local level. So he serves as archon of Chaeronea, kind of like mayor, I guess, is our closest equivalent. He's very involved in the administration of the Delphic Oracle. And he comments occasionally on what that kind of life entails. He says at one point in this work that comes to us in the Moralia, translated the Precepts of Statecraft, that some of his friends will make fun of him, you know, when he's accepting a delivery of like marble or, you know, whatever, some building materials. And he says, they're wrong to make fun of me, because even though it's a little thing that I'm doing, it's just with this little town, you know, has to do with building materials, this sort of stuff, like fixing the potholes, that kind of thing. It's not ignoble. There's something noble about public service, no matter what level you do it on, such that I think Plutarch isn't being ironic with us when he says that he actually draws some inspiration for his own political life, even on a very small scale, from the sort of investigation that he does into the lives of the great figures of the Greek and Roman past, like Pericles and Alexander and the rest of them.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, even envisioning what it would mean to be the manager of the Delphic Oracle is such a funny historical exercise.
He's a member of a committee.
Right. I mean, the idea of philosophy and Plutarch as a philosopher has come up so, like, basically in every single answer that you've given so far. So I think it has come time to address it in full.
Let's do it.
It does not strike me as the typical thing that would stand out to one when one opens the Parallel Lives or some work of Plutarch to think, oh, this is really in some deep way about philosophy as opposed to being about history. So can you defend for me a little bit why that's the case, what the tools are that Plutarch gives us to, you know, disencode that from what he says?
Yes. Yeah, so maybe it's worth just starting with a little bit of background, which might be helpful, on just, you know, the works by Plutarch that come down to us. So they're divided into two big parts, the Parallel Lives, which is by far his most famous work, and that he actually intended as a work. He refers to it as the Parallel Lives. But then we have this other collection called the Moralia. That is not written by Plutarch as a work. He didn't title anything the Moralia. Instead, it's kind of a catch-all for everything we have that isn't written as a Parallel Life. That's helpful for thinking about what he's doing as a philosopher, though, because in the Moralia are a lot of, you know, treatises, dialogues that feel like what we think of, I think, when we say philosophy. So, for instance, he has a a piece on Plato's Timaeus, where he gives an interpretation of what Plato was doing in the Timaeus. He has, you know, various investigations into theological phenomena, into even in some biological works that I find very interesting, like a work about whether sea animals or land animals are more intelligent. You know, so there's all sorts of, you know, obscure, interesting things that don't seem to have anything necessarily to do with practical matters, with the history of the Greek cities, with statesmen, anything of that. So that's one way in which we can say he has the range that we might expect of philosopher, I guess. But I think the Parallel Lives, even on their own terms, merit the attention that we'd give to philosophical works, because even though his primary interest, as he tells us and as we see when we just read it, is not investigating, let's say, metaphysics, or the nature of the cosmos or anything like this, he is interested in permanent things. He's interested in understanding the soul, the human soul, as it exists always and everywhere. And he has a particular way of investigating that. You know, he develops this literary form that, you know, is nearly unprecedented when he's doing it, which is writing these Parallel Lives, you know, not just a biography that was done well before Plutarch, but writing two biographies, putting them in parallel with one another. And I think for this philosophical purpose that he wants us to be able to compare, contrast, come to a judgment about these two individuals set in parallel with one another in order to kind of deepen our understanding of the souls that he's showing us. But it's in that kind of ethical concern. What is the human soul? What are its virtues and vices? How do we kind of investigate that and understand it? That's where I think the kind of philosophical, you know, interest that we see in the lives shows up.
Can you give some examples of ways in which, or particular lives in which, you know, the way that he tells it sort of makes some sort of philosophical point?
Yeah, sure. So my favorite example of this is Lycurgus and Numa. It's the one I've written the most about.
Yeah.
But I think it's the one where the kind of, this philosophical intent of Plutarch is clearest. So we see this in part in the narratives that Plutarch tells, the stories he picks out. In Lycurgus's case, he describes the kind of preface, the educational process that Lycurgus goes through prior to giving the laws to Sparta. He says this includes traveling, you know, around the world. And he says in particular that Lycurgus visits the Cretans and the Ionians, and that the way he tries to understand, what he needs to understand to give laws to Sparta, right, is he puts the Cretans and the Ionians in parallel with one another. And he puts them in parallel, Plutarch says, in order to understand their lives and their regimes. So he shows in the body of his lives, in the action of it, right, a figure who's going through the kind of intellectual process that Plutarch himself sets up for his reader, putting things in parallel in order to understand not only their lives, but also the political implications, the city, the regime, you know, that those lives reflect. And so there's lots of examples like that in the lives where one of his characters is kind of doing an intellectual activity like the ones that, Plutarch sets up. We also see it, though, in the way that Plutarch arranges the pairs, this kind of philosophical intent. So in the Lycurgus Numa, just to stick with this example, he gives us two lawgivers. They're very different lawgivers, right? They're similar in that they come from, we could say, broadly the same character type. They're both giving laws. But one is eminently practical, interested in arranging competitions and kind of harnessing the power of ambition, the love of honor, using it for the good of the city. That's Lycurgus. The other, interested in more religious matters, in showing, you know, taking advantage of the soul's capacity to wonder at the world around it, to be curious about what's going on outside the city, is interested in how you harness those passions in order to establish a kind of political authority, which Numa is capable of exercising because he knows how that part of the soul works. So we have a similarity there, but also this vast difference. And in thinking about how these two lawgivers show us the type in different forms, we should, I think this is Plutarch's intent, be able to discover something about the nature of lawgiving and the, you know, the different potential that we have in our soul always, you know, to interact with laws and politics in different ways.
And do you think that there's something kind of, maybe this is too basic of a question, but, you know, particularly Platonic about that project, or ways in which some of the big names of philosophy that Plutarch was such a big fan of themselves actually come up?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. There's something kind of Platonic about it in that, you know, in the and, you know, the Plato shows us philosophy as it exists when a philosopher is having a conversation with other people, right?
Oh, that's a really interesting point.
Yeah, so there are characters, right? There are characters, you know, the action of the dialogue is just as important as the argument in many cases. You know, there's that sort of thing. Plutarch shows us these characters in dialogue. That's part of what we get out of the stories as we see them interacting and speaking with people. He also gives us a lot of their sayings, their memorable sayings, so he's by no means indifferent to the speeches that these statesmen make. That said, the main kind of dialogic action in the lives is really between the two members of the pair. You know, that's what we're presented to see, is the life of Pericles and the life of Fabius, the life of Lycurgus, the life of Numa. And it's almost as if we're supposed to put them together, right, into a kind of conversation that we create in order to understand really, you know, what we can learn from the lives. So that's different than Plato, but I think coming out of a broadly Platonic view, you know, that you need to see kind of different viewpoints and interaction with each other in order to really do the activity of reasoning and philosophizing.
That's a really interesting point. But it also strikes me that it's a really interesting juxtaposition in that it seems quite controversial, right? The Sparta is not a regime that I think we today are able to look back on with much understanding or much sympathy in a lot of ways. And Numa also, I mean, stands for, I mean, a kind of religious fervor that I think is also in some ways hard for us to empathize with from a governmental perspective. So I guess looking at those two different regimes, does Plutarch seem to kind of, how does he portray them?
Well, I might just disagree with you a little bit, Annika, about the enduring appeal of Sparta.
It sort of is, it sort of isn't. I mean, I think it, in a very broad sense, we look back on it and think it seemed. But then, you know, when you dig into some of the details of it, it's quite difficult to even wrap our, I mean, our heads around what living in a society like that could even be like. It's just so radically different from the way that we govern now.
I agree completely. And I think there are lots of moral commitments that I'd want to defend that lead us to condemn different elements.
Right.
So, you know,
right.
We don't have to list them, you know, but from slavery on down. And
right.
So, yeah.
Slavery, yeah. Throwing babies off cliffs, etc.
There's a lot of stuff you wouldn't recommend, right?
Yeah.
It's a policy proposal. And yet, you know, Plutarch gives us a broadly sympathetic view of Sparta and really highlights the kind of defensible, more appealing elements of it that I think we have some resonance with. I mean, it might just be the kinds of people I hang out with in my day-to-day life. You know, I have a lot of friends in the military, but there's a kind of...
West Point is very Spartan,
I mean,
so...
There are elements of it, for sure. I mean, there's something about the toughness, you know, about the, you know, seeing the military as a valuable, like, avenue for, you know, expressing one's virtue and one's commitment to the city or the nation. I mean, you know, there are these elements that that Sparta still, I think, captures for us, to say nothing of the kind of permanent appeal that we see in pop culture.
Yeah.
You know, the Spartan example. But it is different too. Plutarch, it's interesting to me anyway, you know, again, picks up the kind of, let's say, more appealing aspects of Sparta without entirely denying the others. And the life of Lycurgus, for instance, he presents, right. You know, Sparta as this kind of cosmos, this ordered whole with internal motion, competition, striving after honor, but it has a kind of beauty when you stand back from it and see the design of the whole thing. He tells us that largely without talking about the Helots. But then in the comparison, you know, so he'll do a life of one person, life of another, always a Greek, always a Roman. But then he writes these little texts at the end called the Synchresis, right? As a kind of comparison or judgment. In that particular judgment, the Lycurgus Enuma, he reintroduces, you know, some of the nasty institutions that Sparta has, the Kryptia, this kind of secret police that goes out and slaughters Helots at night. Horrible stuff, right? And he introduces that as something we should consider when we're evaluating Lycurgus Enuma. So he's a very interesting figure, I think, in how he presents it. He's generally in a sympathetic view. He gives a warts and all picture of the statesman, but doesn't want to really, you know, overemphasize the warts, let's say. But he has ways of indicating, you know, that even in doing that, he's aware of some of the problems too.
Can you talk a little bit about this concept of philotimia and his sort of Plutarch's complicated view of it?
Yeah, so philotimia, the love of honor, or we might translate it ambition. But I think the love of honor, that literal translation, is helpful because it's the passion that you know, Plutarch statesmen have, we have too, you know, that likes to be praised by other people, you know, likes to avoid blame whenever possible. It's painful. So there's a very old, very well established in Plutarch's day, still with us, tradition of philosophers criticizing this passion, saying that, you know, it might not be the lowest passion that we have, but it's, you know, broadly an accusation when you say someone is ambitious. Plutarch, you know, is aware of that critique of this passion. In some senses, I think he shares it. I don't think he holds it out as the highest possible thing. But one interesting thing of the way he presents these statesmen to us is he'll call our attention to the ways in which philotimia is very important in living a, you know, a positive, virtuous life. It's a kind of energy in the soul. If you're looking for a student to educate, to do great things, you'd prefer a student who's ambitious as opposed to someone who's not ambitious at all, right? Not because winning glory and, you know, having thousands of people chanting your name is necessarily the highest form of human life, but there's a kind of longing to do something big and notable that can lead to virtue and in kind of outstanding, you know, displays. Also can be channeled into, you know, commitments to virtue that, you know, allow you to act virtuously regardless of whether anyone is watching or not. So Plutarch is really, I think, sensitive in a way that is not unique, but is particularly, I think, worthwhile when we're, you know, examining him to be sensitive to this, of the value, the potential value of this passion, ambition.
I want to get a little bit more specific when we talk about virtue in Plutarch, because I think, I mean, it's a major theme, obviously, in the work, and it's a really interesting topic that I think sometimes we can just sort of take the word for granted and not really dig into what it means. You have this great quote in your book from Nietzsche that the characters in Plutarch are raised in this unmodern way, that is to say, become mature and accustomed to the heroic. And I wonder if, you know, when you look at the way that virtue is portrayed in Plutarch, you agree with Nietzsche that there's something kind of fundamentally unmodern or foreign about it, or if you think that mostly it's kind of similar with the way we think about political virtue today.
No, I think there's something unmodern and foreign about it. And I think that's the value of these books. I mean, I don't think there's a whole lot of value to reading books that just reaffirm everything you think about the world and don't challenge you to see something that you might have missed starting from the assumptions that you start from. Plutarch holds up for admiration statesmen, right? He says that there's a particular way that virtue shows itself in political life that's worth contemplating, admiring, emulating, even if we don't do it in exactly the way they did, even if we're like mayor of a small town in Greece, right? Maybe there's something we can take, you know, from these great statesmen and maybe understand the passions in our own soul better by virtue of seeing them writ large, right, in these lives. What does it mean to read those kind of lives today, right? With you know, different set of assumptions, I think, about the value of private versus public life, the value of, you know, pursuing wealth versus pursuing honor. I mean, we start from a different set of assumptions about whether conquering people is a good thing or a bad thing, right? There's all sorts of assumptions that Plutarch, you know, is at least starting from that are different than ours. I don't think one necessarily has to read Plutarch for Nietzschean reasons in order to read Plutarch.
That's a great relief to me.
At least I hope not. And, you know, Plutarch was very widely read by virtually everyone who's, you know, educated, right. Prior to Nietzsche. And it's partly, I think, because of Nietzsche's praise of Plutarch that he's fallen out of fashion a little bit, you know, among people with more egalitarian commitments.
Interesting.
Than Nietzsche and probably Plutarch has too. So what do we learn from this? It's hard to say. I mean, the set of virtues we see is definitely a more ancient set of virtues than we're accustomed to. Courage figures very prominently, the kind of prudence that shows itself in statesmanship. I don't think in any way these are outmoded or obsolete, right? So it's a helpful corrective maybe to some of our assumptions. But it is a bit untimely in a way that should, I think, be really appealing to us. Not a reason for, you know, casting Plutarch aside.
Yeah, I think the idea of empire and that being a really big difference between ancient and modern ways of looking at the world is really key. And I think especially the case of Plutarch is quite interesting because he is himself an imperial subject, a Greek being ruled by the Romans, and then writing a book which really explicitly compares those two, you know, traditions and histories. And so, I mean, this is sort of a broad question, and maybe we can answer it broadly and then drill a little bit deeper. But, I mean, how do you kind of square his attitude towards empire? It seems to me basically to be a positive view with his kind of own personal cultural position?
Yeah. That's a good and really hard question to answer. So Plutarch doesn't give us a whole lot in terms of his political opinions about the politics of his own day. It's not prevalent, I'd say, in the parallel lives, exactly where he falls on what kind of, you know, empire he'd like to live in. Mm. In the Moralia, sometimes it comes up. I think broadly, just to speak very broadly about it, you could say that he's not a revolutionary. He doesn't present himself that way in any event, right? He doesn't say that the days when the Greek cities were free were better, or the days when Rome was a republic was better. Therefore, we should return to that, try to restore it. He says, in fact, that talking that way is pretty dangerous, and it sacrifices the good things that the empire does preserve, like peace, for instance. Mm. Peace is a good thing, Plutarch says, right? And that's something we have. In one of the pieces in the Moralia, he says that the Greek cities have some freedom now, and perhaps more freedom wouldn't be better for them. So he seems to broadly be not a revolutionary, kind of broadly in favor of the empire. That said, I think he is in favor of a particular kind of empire and against another. So he seems to favor a vision of the Greek empire in which the cities, the Greek cities, and other, you know, subject peoples are relatively free, right? Which is to say, if Rome was calling all of the shots, dictating to all of the local, you know, Greek officials exactly what they should do, that would be a worse situation, according to Plutarch. He thinks some freedom is important for political life, even on the local level, having the kind of dignity and rewarding, you know, some expression of ambition. And so he's in favor of that. So a view of the empire where the cities are relatively more free as opposed to relatively less free. It's a little bit like in Tacitus, where, you know, there's plenty of praise of the noble senators, the more courageous senators in Tacitus, criticism of senators who just kowtow to the emperors and flatter and so on. It seems safe to say that Tacitus is in favor of a stronger rather than a weaker Senate within the empire. I don't think it follows from that he wants to overturn the empire and restore the republic. There's a little bit like that, that kind of sentiment in Plutarch as well. While we're on that point, though, let me just say one thing, just to revise and extend a little bit before. When we think about, you know, what's untimely and what might be accessible to us as moderns in Plutarch, the fact that he's writing under the empire actually is a really important thing, I think, to hold on to, just in terms of how we, given our assumptions that we start from, relate to him. So he's writing at a time when, as he understands it, politics, and really the great politics of the free cities and the republic, are in a certain sense in the past. You know, I mean, they're going on in a way too in the empire, but there's a way in which like private life matters a lot more to him than it does to the figures he's writing about, because he's living at a time when a lot of political space is just filled up by the Romans and by the emperor. It shows in the way he presents himself to us. You know, we have him as a local mayor and that sort of thing. He also tells us about his family. You know, he tells us about his kids. We know a little bit about the kind of life he lived at home. So this sensitivity to the goodness of private life is something that I think we identify more with modern than ancient authors.
Interesting.
It's something that Plutarch articulates in his work. And I think, you know, at least to my reading of him, all the more interesting, you know, that he holds up these old forms of politics to us for our admiration, you know, because he's aware of the attractions of this other way of kind of balancing public and private too.
And it has been much remarked upon that he is very focused on the Republican period of Rome. I guess there's a lot of debate about what sort of loyalties that reflects, but it does strike me as something that gets pulled through in a lot of the thinkers who admire him, like Machiavelli and like the founders, this kind of fixation on that particular period of Roman history. So can you speak a little bit to your best educated guess, why he sort of has that focus, and B, the ways in which that has influenced later thinkers?
Yeah, I think he's very consciously writing about a particular period in time, right? So it's not just by accident, like he runs out of material or something, that the last of his Greeks, Philopoemen, is alive at the time when the Greek cities finally fall under the sway of Rome.
Right.
It's not an accident that the last of his Romans, Antony, is alive when the Republic gives way to the Empire, right? So he's very consciously picking a particular constellation of politics, a particular period to write about. Why is he doing that under the Empire? I mean, one thing you can say, which is true, is that it wasn't so weird under the Empire when he's writing to, think about those times in political life. It could be kind of revolutionary. There are times, Plutarch will say at times that in the Greek politics of his day, you have to be very careful how you invoke, Marathon and these kind of great battles where the Greeks are fighting, standing up to the Persians and resisting empire and so on, because it can lead people to kind of lose their heads and do dangerous things, right? Mm-hmm. But he's speaking about it in a way, I think, because we see most clearly the political virtues under republics, under free cities, and we can then kind of understand the nature of politics better as a kind of a way of highlighting virtues that might be a little bit untimely even in Plutarch's own time. So that the meaning, the kind of dignity of political life is a lot more evident when you're contemplating Pericles than when you're contemplating, a small town mayor of Chaeronea.
If the goal is to prevent people from being hot-headed and doing crazy things, then why portray people like Alexander?
Yeah, well, I think partly we can learn through seeing the excesses, about some of the dangers. Plutarch very explicitly says in one pair, the Demetrius and Antony, that he's going to give us a negative example.
Right.
So maybe in some of the other lives, again, it's not hero worship, right? He's giving us fairly subtle, sophisticated pictures of these people. But, they're oriented more towards praise than blame, let's say, in general. And the Demetrius Antony says, I'm going to give you a bad example so you learn what not to do. That said, when he writes the lives, there are a lot of praiseworthy things too. So none of this is straightforward in how he writes it. But that's part of it, is I think he wants you to see, kind of excesses as well as just the virtues. So you can understand the soul, because that's really fundamentally what he wants to do.
Yeah, and it's funny because even Antony, I think, has survived history as, if not a figure that people necessarily look up to, a very compelling figure in a lot of ways.
Well, Plutarch's been helped by a lot of his readers, including, this playwright who wrote some really great secondary literature on Plutarch's lives. So he's incredibly influential.
Plutarch, that would be William Shakespeare
That's right. So Shakespeare draws deeply on these lives. And it's really a nice way, if we love Shakespeare but haven't read Plutarch, a wonderful way in just to reflect on why Shakespeare found this particular author. Not only, you read Seneca and some others too, but he found this particular author such a valuable window onto what the ancient world was really about, for the Antony and Cleopatra, for Coriolanus, for Julius Caesar, for Timon of Athens too, and some other plays.
I think one of the points that you make in your book, which is really interesting, is that we are currently having kind of a crisis of citizenship, and that Plutarch can be useful for that. And that goes along with a general lack of appreciation for the genre of biography. So I want to take a little bit of time to talk about the genre of biography, because it seems that it is a very popular genre in a lot of different forms. I mean, including pop historians, Britney Spears's autobiography is a big, it's sort of a funny, ridiculous parallel, but that sort of style of, that deep personal kind of cut about motivations definitely has a lot of popular sway. And yet, Plutarch's particular style, as we've discussed, is very much out of favor within the academy broadly. So can you talk a little bit about what you think actually our republic needs and can gain from this type of writing? We've talked about Plutarch's big goal. What's your big goal with this?
Yeah, no, I love the idea that Plutarch's going to save the republic. That's a great idea. That's probably a little too much to put on him, but, you know, it can't hurt. So biography, it's really fascinating to me, just the status of biography in general today. And Plutarch, you know, is called the Prince of Biographers by Boswell. He's, you know, clearly a prominent kind of entrepreneur in the field of biography. Biography today seems to me it wants to be very popular. In a sense, like, you know, you see biographies very frequently on the bestseller list. Autobiographies, memoirs are very popular as well. And incredibly well done. I would not in a million years. I have not read Britney Spears' biography.
Probably not.
But I'm sure it's good. But yeah, I will say Bruce Springsteen's autobiography is one of the best biographies I've read, period. I mean, it's really amazing. So they're very, very good. Plutarch notably doesn't write, you know, biographies of artists or of philosophers. Mm. That's another way we can kind of see his interest in statesmen and political life. You know, by what he kind of excludes from his interests. But we live in a golden age of biography. Robert Caro's biographies are, you know, the best ever. You know, David McCall, there are all these wonderful, even Walter Isaacson, I think, is, you know, again, like focusing on a type of person that Plutarch doesn't write about, but really fantastic, you know, works that are very popular. So what is it about biographies that mean so much to us? Plutarch says, when he talks about what he is doing in writing a biography, that, you know, as I mentioned, he's looking for the signs of the soul, that he's giving us intimate access to people who, because they're famous and well-known, right, it's easy to think of them as far off, right, not really to see them as real human beings. And Plutarch, in a way, kind of takes us inside the tent, you know, lets us see them up close, really understand who they are, what the passions are in their soul, you know, what they were like when you spoke to them. And that can be really appealing, I think, just that sense of intimacy with someone who otherwise seems really big and far off. And that's interesting. It maybe appeals to our curiosity, maybe wonder in its highest, you know, form, in some sense, express itself that way. But I think the reason Plutarch really loves that effect that biography gives you isn't so much just to appeal to curiosity or teach us little details about these guys, but he holds out biography as having the capacity to shape the reader's soul in a way that other forms of writing do not. So he says, for instance, and this is in the introduction to the Pericles, that when human beings see a virtuous deed, it's different than looking at a beautiful statue or looking at, you know, someone who has a skill like playing piano really well. When we see a virtuous deed, there's something in us. This is Plutarch's analysis of our soul, right? That just responds to that in a way that we want to do that too. We want to kind of emulate someone when we're shown virtue in the right way. So he understands himself to be acting as a kind of intermediary between what he calls the noble, right, or the good, and us, the readers, by means of these figures that he can hold out and give us a kind of intimate access to in such a way that we really can be inspired, you know, live differently, shape our own soul, kind of see how we measure up to these great people he's holding out to us. He thinks that that happens in biography in a way that it doesn't in when you're reading just a history or a dialogue or anything like that. And I have to say, I mean, you know, to some extent, that claim for biography might be a little bit exaggerated, but I've seen this happen, you know, in teaching Plutarch and in studying biographies, that if you really want to inspire someone to live a particular way of life, this is true in my own life too. I mean, there's no better way, I think, than really reading a biography and trying to understand what that life really is like, you know, from the person's perspective.
Yeah, I really like the way that you put that, because it does strike me that given that, Plutarch is actually quite a bit more practical than a lot of people might initially think. I mean, even within, there's sort of a question of the humanities practical broadly, and then a narrower question of, is it practical to read someone who's essentially making things up? although that's a little harsh, as we've discussed, but broadly. I really... especially given that you teach at West Point, which is a very practically oriented institution, I wonder if you could speak a little bit to the practicality of Plutarch or ways in which you've seen it impact people.
Yeah, I think the humanities are practical and they're not practical, right? I mean, at least the way I approach these books like Plutarch, I mean, I really couldn't care less whether it helps my students like get promoted at faster rates or, you know, get a better job in business or whatever. That, I mean, practicality in that, I mean, it's nice, I guess, if the humanities actually lead people to get better jobs and make a bigger income. It's not, you know, you shouldn't be indifferent to that. But I don't think that's the reason why we engage with these books. I mean, we engage with these books because of this deep, really important practical matter of how should we live? Mm. You know, it's a question that each of us has to answer in our own way. And we have lots of different options for how to live well. One of them is the kind of political life that Plutarch holds up to us and allows us to understand both in its weaknesses and what's really attractive and beautiful about it. So, you know, to me, that's a very practical thing, but it's not the sort of thing we're worried about, you know, kind of, you know, getting ahead in the world or anything like that. I've taught Plutarch. I've had the real privilege of teaching Plutarch in an institution, the mission of which is to educate, train, and inspire leaders of character for a lifetime of service to the army and the nation. West Point takes that mission really seriously, and it really infuses everything that's done there. I mean, from military training to what happens in the classroom. And it's a wonderful environment in which to really study, you know, great leaders from the past and try to understand from them. Not, you know, as a matter of hero worship by a long shot, but just to understand all the ways that human beings can do well when they live lives of, you know, public service and the ways they can go horribly wrong and screw up, right? Because you want to know about those early on, too. And so I will say, like, I think there's something about, you know, the environment I've had the privilege of teaching for the last 10 years or so and the stuff I work on that really, you know, it goes well together.
Really appreciate you saying that. Speaking of people who actually did read Plutarch in a very extremely straightforwardly practical way, I would be remiss, given that we're the Madison program, if I didn't ask a little bit about the founders. How, before we start wrapping this up, how did Plutarch's work impact the founding fathers?
It had a big impact on them. It was really
I'm
important.
Shocked.
So... I mean, you know, a lot of the pseudonyms that they used in the Federalist Papers, Publius comes from the life of Publicola, is paired with Solon, you know, but a lot of others too, Brutus, Cato, a lot of the people we know from the pseudonyms of, you know, various writings at the time of the founders come to us from Plutarch. But I think the effect is a lot deeper than that. You know, we have the notebooks that Alexander Hamilton, as a young aide-de-camp to George Washington, kept. As best we can tell by a kind of candlelight in his tent, you know, he read the lives of Plutarch at a time when he knew that he was involved in something great, you know, the founding of a new republic. And he really studied them carefully, took notes on them, drew inspiration. He was particularly interested, apropos of what we were saying a second ago, in the lives of Spartans. They seem to have had a really intimate impact on a number of founders. In terms of just what are we doing? What is political life? What are the nature of the kind of passions we're bringing to this as leaders, you know, in this great new enterprise that seems in some way or another to be kind of resonant with some of the stuff we've read about in ancient history. I'll say another way that Plutarch, I think, helps us get a window onto the founding period. At this point, it's not original to me by a long shot. You know, Douglas Adair, Joanne Freeman, a lot of other really great scholars have made this point that the American founders were moved not only by, you know, virtue, certainly not, you know, only by like wealth and that sort of thing, but by honor, by the idea that they would be, you know, praised, remembered for a long time if the enterprise they were involved in worked, right? They were ambitious, not in a low sense, but in the really great sense. And I think there's a way in which that passion that many of them, probably most of them, had in their souls really resonated with what they saw on the page in Plutarch. So it goes back to this passion of philotimia that we were talking about. Mm. You know, a philotimos person can spot other philotimoi. The ambitious people can spot the ambitious. And I think the ambitious can also spot authors like Plutarch who help them to really reflect on that passion and see different forms of it so they can understand better how to live as an ambitious person in a noble, virtuous way and not to end up like Demetrius Antony and a bunch of other folks who maybe went the wrong way.
Has being a scholar of Plutarch made you read the genre of biography in general differently?
Yes. I'm much more conscious, I think, of the ethical impact of biography than I was without Plutarch. Like, I'm a little more conscious of the effect that reading, say, the life of a Steve Jobs or even a Bruce Springsteen can have on the way, you know, I view my own life, the way I think about different, you know, commitments I have and so on. So I think that happens whether you're conscious of it or not when you read biography. But, you know, reading a great biographer and reflecting on what he was doing when he wrote biography, I think really highlights that element of reading biographies. Another way that Plutarch has definitely impacted me is we have relatively few parallel lives, even though I think we arguably live in a golden age of biography. Mm. This idea of writing biographies together, that's not quite as in fashion as it was, you know, when Plutarch was writing, for sure. I mean, he made it in fashion. And that's, you know, I think about that a lot, too. Like, there's a way in which, like, comparing and contrasting similar sorts of lives, I think, has a particular kind of philosophical, like, significance that I've kind of carried into my own practice of reading biographies, you know, holding up people alongside one another to understand their souls better than if you just saw them in isolation.
Yeah, that's a really lovely point. And then one last question to close us out here. Having read one of the few people who has sat through the entirety of the lives, which are quite long, it strikes me that a lot of texts, I mean, I think of the Bible, for instance, and how, you know, when you read the Bible, there are certain texts, but maybe feel sort of uniquely present. Do you ever have that sense reading Plutarch? And are there particular lives that you feel like seem as if they ought to have been written for people today?
Well, all of the lives are worth reading. Let me start there. So you absolutely should read it cover to cover.
Never the said they weren't.
The Bible too. No, but let me. So all of the lives are worth reading. But yeah, some of them inevitably have particular resonance given the kind of, you know, the politics you're living through. For me, I mentioned the Lycurgus Pneuma just as being, I think, the most useful pair for getting a sense of what Plutarch is doing with the project as a whole. Mm-hmm. So I think that's not a bad place to start. I've become very interested in discussions around the decline of the Republic, you know, whether America or, you know, the West, whatever, like, is lost, whether we're in a moment of decline and fall. I've written a little bit on Edward Gibbon, too. This is a theme that's near and dear to my heart. Plutarch has a few pairs of lives that are particularly valuable for contemplating that question, the issue of decline and fall and how to live well at a time when, you know, either there's an opportunity for renewal or maybe not. And so just to recommend a few of those. So Plutarch, you know, wrote 22 pairs of biographies. We have 46 lives that are in the parallel lives. The reason that we have 46, not 44, is he wrote one pair that's a special double pair where he has Agis and Cleomenes, these Spartan kings, paired with the Gracchi, the great reformers, you know, of Rome. I think that pair is particularly resonant with some of our concerns in that Agis and Cleomenes are consciously trying to restore a regime that they understand to have fallen away from its kind of original intent in one way or another. Agis actually reads the life of Lycurgus, becomes familiar with his way of life. He engages in this kind of activity that Plutarch holds out as motivating his whole project. And on the basis of that reading and engagement with the life of Lycurgus, decides that he's going to try to restore the Lycurgan regime. Hmm. And so he and Cleomenes try it. It's an interesting thing for us to contemplate. Gracchi, too, try in their own way to restore the old republic. And I hope I won't be spoiling anything for the listeners, you know, for anyone else, to say it doesn't necessarily work out as they planned. That's, I think, a very, you know, good lesson for anyone who's concerned with projects of restoration, averting decline and fall, to kind of contemplate. And a slightly gloomier side of that, maybe, there's a pair that I really love, the Cato the Younger and Phocion, that I'll mention, too. Phocion, I think, is the most underrated of Plutarch's lives. I have to recommend that. Phocion is the statesman when Athens is falling under the sway of Macedon, who opposes Demosthenes. Demosthenes says, we'll fight them at the beaches. We will never, you know, give in. We must oppose them and maintain Athens' independence at all costs. Phocion says, we should probably give in. Right? We aren't the Athens we used to be. We should make our peace, get the best possible deal we can. He does that in a way that shows you the virtues associated with that kind of position, which is not one I think that we're accustomed to think of as heroic or admirable. So it shows us in a way the power of Plutarch's art as a biographer, that he's able to hold up someone like Phocion and give us access to the kinds of virtues, you know, that life entails. And also, you know, let us really think about the limitations of that way of relating to decline and fall versus some others that are maybe more obviously noble. Hmm.
Well, thank you so much, Hugh. This has been absolutely a fascinating discussion. And I would absolutely encourage listeners to read the Parallel Lives. But also, if they're too long, then Hugh has a really wonderful book on it, which will be linked in the show notes. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Annika.
Well, there you have it, Madisonians, Dr. Hugh Liebert on Plutarch's politics and Plutarch's philosophy. His book is linked in the show notes, and you can also find out more about us and what we do here at the Madison Program at jmp.princeton.edu. There, you can find the full list of events that we host here on Princeton's campus, both those that are still upcoming this semester and recordings of all the really fascinating events that we've had in the past. You can also find us on social media, on Twitter at Madison Program, as well as on Instagram and Facebook. Finally, if you enjoyed this episode, please do consider leaving us any ratings or reviews. We really do appreciate it. Again, thank you so much for tuning in, and I can't wait to see you next week here on Madison's Notes.